Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the A-List with me, Jennifer Lindsay. Every week, we chat with an influencer to see what makes them tick. And today, Wednesday, January 13th, 2010, I am delighted to welcome Ryan Kahlo, who is an academic fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford University. Welcome, Ryan.
Thanks for having me, Jennifer.
We were on a panel a while ago, and we were able to meet, and I am just thrilled that you're able to be on the show because obviously you do a lot of interesting research. But let's start at the beginning for folks who might be going, what is the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford, and what is it trying to accomplish? And I'll let you answer that question.
Absolutely. So we're a center that's situated in the Stanford Law School, and we were founded almost 10 years ago by Larry Lessig, who's the author of many books, including Free Culture and Code 2.0 and many others. And we're dedicated to studying the intersection of technology and society, and particularly the law. And we do three kinds of things, basically. One of the things we do is we work on fair use and copyright. So that's the right of individuals to use something that that might be copyrighted, but there are certain uses to which you might be allowed to put it. And so in that capacity, we defend artists and others, writers, for being able to use certain kinds of materials. And then in addition to that, we also have an interesting documentary review program. And what that does is for people that are selected for the program, we actually go through someone's documentary and we look at all the stuff that might be copyrighted. And then we certify whether we think it's all fair use, and that makes it, in cases, easier for people to get insurance so that, because, you know, a lot of films end up getting some pushback for using, especially documentaries, for using material that is said to be copyrighted. So that's one part of us. Another part of us studies things like how do complex systems like the Internet, what's the best way to physically build them so that you preserve the conditions for innovation and free speech? So what's the best way to actually, like, rig the Internet and set it up so that everybody can benefit from it the most. And the current faculty director, Barbara Vanshevik, is a really international expert on that. And she's trained as both a computer scientist and as a lawyer. And she's on the faculty at Stanford Law School. And then the third thing is what I do, which is the Consumer Privacy Project. And so what we do is we try to enhance consumer privacy, by advocacy. So we participate in many of the debates and file comments before agencies and things like that. But we also try to build some tools from scratch that really, help individual consumers, educate them, and hopefully even drive the market towards better privacy and security practices. So that's our center in a nutshell.
So what kind of work have you been working on most recently that is most applicable to maybe, everyday users who might be listening to this podcast through iTunes that are commuting? Can you talk about some research or work that you're doing in that area right now?
Absolutely. I mean, as I mentioned, sometimes we build products and things from scratch. And one of those efforts is a website that we're developing that's going to be called whatapp.org. And what it is think of a kind of consumer report, but actually for apps. So all the iPhone apps or Facebook apps, all the different little apps that you might download to your mobile or online to your computer, this is a place where experts review that stuff and kick the tires on it and see whether it has good security, whether it has good privacy, whether it has values of openness. The effort there is so people can go there and search based on platform and individual product. And it provides like a little review. Like I said, it's kind of like a consumer report, but for digital objects.
So how does the validation process work? Who's reviewing, and how do you know that they have the same, that's the whole thing is kind of, some of this is pretty subjective in terms of, what's private enough or what's protective enough. How does that get maintained within the website environment?
That's a great question. So the way it's set up is that the experts have to be approved by our staff. And I'm going to give you some examples of experts that we're reaching out to. So some of them are actual institutions. So we're going to approach the computer science department at Stanford and ask them to do some security audits and look at some of these apps and describe some of the vulnerabilities. And based on that, you know, answer a rating questionnaire, and then maybe even provide some descriptions. And so these are parties that are trusted, and I should say they're trusted really by the Center for Internet and Society largely. Others are other organizations include, I'm going to be approaching the Center for Democracy and Technology about some of their interesting work on looking at different privacy policies. So we're trying to pick folks that already are respected and have the relevant expertise. But it's a great question, and that's true. People differ. I will say this, though. One of our concerns is that developers themselves, the people that make these apps, have a voice. And so we're going to have a whole corner called Developer Notes that features very, very prominently, where developers themselves will be able to talk about what they did in terms of privacy and security and openness that makes their product good. So these reviews will not exist in isolation, and there'll be an opportunity for individual users to comment and also for developers. And finally, there's a feature that automatically generates relevant news about the product. About the app. And so people will be able to go there and have a sort of a one-stop shop for all kinds of different information. So part of it is that we trust the people that are doing the reviews, and part of it is that we rely on an abundance of information so that the user can make their own assessment at the end of the day.
And how much interaction can the community itself have in terms of, you know, so sort of looking at the comparison of, let's say, Facebook applications and the way, you know, users can rate them, you know, any user of the device. Is there a way for just the everyday average user that may have had a particular experience for them to share that experience?
Right now, there are two opportunities for users to comment. One of them is that they can edit a wiki description. So they can, you know, people can put that in there, and people can change it if they disagree. Again, subject ultimately to moderation by us. The second thing is that there's a free form for comments, so users can literally write whatever they want in the comments section, and that's not edited in any way. However, there's also a mechanism that won't go live initially, which allows users to actually sort of rate on an up or down scale what they feel about the product, akin to maybe the way you might vote up or down Dig on Dig.com or some other of these, Karma and the like, these other expedients. But that will not roll out initially. And the thinking of why that won't roll out initially is because we want to have some content there already to provide some context. So we have a couple initial ways to talk and form a community, and then we have some ways slated down the line.
And so when does the website go live?
Well, it doesn't go live for another few months, but it's going to start being opened up to the expert community within the next month. And so the idea is to really start the process of loading it up with good content. Right now it's a shell. It's not publicly accessible, and it merely has a lot of the apps on there with some of the content in place, but it lacks some of the important content. So everybody else won't be able to see it. That said, if your listeners are developers with an app that want to brag about it, or if they're experts who want to talk about it, they can feel free to get in touch with the Center for Internet and Society, and I can make sure that we know how to reach out to them.
So cyberlaw.stanford.edu, is that the address they should go to?
That's exactly right. Yep, they sure should. Yep.
Okay, we'll add that.
You can actually.
Go ahead.
Sorry. Okay. Also, they can see one of my blog posts shows screenshots of the product, so you can see it.
And we already have your blog post linked from my website, and we'll add the, if you want to get in touch, cyberlaw.stanford.edu address as well. One thing I wanted to ask about was the motivation, because obviously there are so many things that you could pick in terms of, you know, the intersection of law and technology. And I mean, certainly mobile applications have exploded, especially with with the iPhone, but even with BlackBerries and other devices, Android apps, that sort of thing. What was the initial, and obviously there's a ramp up. When did you initially start thinking about this, and kind of who came up with the idea, and kind of where did it come from?
Well, so I think that the idea I came up with alongside and in conversation with Lauren Gelman, who is a privacy expert and an attorney in the Bay Area, and she was the executive director of the Center for Internet and Society. And we just basically were sitting around thinking about, you know, what could we do to drive this market in a direction, hopefully, for better privacy and security. We thought at the time, and this was a while back, but, you know, we saw the trends in the direction of a lot of people using apps. And so just to talk for 1 second about the kind of the way we think through issues at the Center for Internet Society, Larry Lessig, as I said, was the founder of the center, and he's maybe best known in my community for the insight that there are different ways to regulate conduct, not just the law, right? So he talks about what he calls the New Chicago School, and it says that there are really four ways to change behavior if you're an authority. One of the ways is just regular law, make it illegal or mandated. Another one is called norms, which is try to influence what people feel about things, you know. And there was a big hubbubu, as you know, about the discussions I the founder of Facebook recently about whether or not our social norms have moved away from privacy. So, and then a third way is through code, and that's the sort of infamous code is law, or the famous code is law statement. Mm-hmm. And that's the idea that you can actually prevent or cause conduct by, you know, by changing people's user interface, by changing their experience directly. And finally, there's this notion that you can change things with markets. And by markets, it just meant that you know, maybe you can make the price of it higher and therefore less common. And that's maybe a one example of that is that people will tax cigarettes a lot because their hope is that people won't smoke as much if they have to pay more. So with this framework in mind that there are these four different ways, we were trying to find a way, and they all have their own advantages and disadvantages, and we were trying to find a way that would improve privacy and security the most and do so in a way that that was as broadly reaching and positive as possible. And we thought that driving the market for these apps by giving people information, so if they chose to choose security and privacy over some other value, that they'd be able to do so. And the problem now is that you go to these, you know, really great websites that where people can talk about and even review apps, but it's really seldom that they talk about privacy and security. Generally speaking, people talk about if it's fun, appropriately so. I mean, or if it's fast or whatever else. And we thought that the values that we cared about were missing. So that's how the whole process got generated. And you know, I'm gratified that apps is moving in the direction that we anticipated, but it was already pretty far along by the time we were thinking about it.
So one question I have is kind of a more basic question, which is that I get asked all the time, especially at speaking events, and this may be something that you don't think about or tackle, but I'd love to get your take on it. Is privacy dead? You know, for someone like me, there's really almost no way for me to divide my personal and private lives, you know, mm-hmm. and that's true for a lot of people these days. Some people encounter a lot of, you know, people react to that in different ways. There's frustration around it. There's concern about, you know, how that'll affect life in the workplace. And it can be a barrier to experimenting with technology or using technologies that actually might enhance one's life. What is your sort of just general take on that? I mean, is privacy dead, or is there a way to sort of separate the personal and private? Because obviously with privacy, you know, and personal, you know, personal issues, you know, we've seen cases where, you know, people revealed things on Twitter, for example, and they were arrested as a result, or some sort of legal action took place.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a really good question, and it's one that has a lot of dimensions. I mean, you can come at it from the perspective of have we as a culture given up on the notion of privacy? Is privacy not something that's important to us? And there I would say pretty resoundingly no. I mean, I think that people have not given up on the notion of privacy. And I think if we look at broader trends, we see a lot of evidence that people continue to care about privacy. I've read some studies recently out of the Annenberg School at and also a joint study with Berkeley that, you know, basically interviewed, for instance, Californians about their privacy attitudes, and they all valued online privacy very much. That's just opinion, but I suppose, but there also, I saw a study that I really thought was interesting out of Carnegie Mellon by Janice Tsai and some Alessandro Acquisti and some other behavioral economist folks that actually showed that people will pay a premium to buy something on a website where they're more, where they feel that it's, that it has better privacy values. So people even vote with their dollars. And then there are sort of broader demographic trends, like, we're moving from small towns, where everybody sort of knows your name, to big cities in droves, where the anonymity is more the norm. And of course, the internet has, even as it's made it possible to share information, so has it made an enormous amount of anonymous speech possible. And so I think that there's a lot of sort of thrust and counter thrust on the argument of whether or not we cease to value privacy anymore. As to whether it's dead as a factual matter, that's a tough one, because, you know, the truth of the matter is that, you know, almost anything that you do on the internet, and we do so much on the internet, that someone can get at it, right? So the government with sufficient process can get at almost everything you do. Maybe if you're a very sophisticated player, you might be able to use a Tor network or some other privacy-enhancing technology to truly obscure your activities. But, our lives are so mediated by technology that it's created an immense number of opportunities for privacy invasion. And it's also true that this is happening outside of the online space. And I think one of the most, intellectually speaking, I think one of the most interesting things about the internet is not what actually happens to us there. It's not what occurs to us, but it's like what occurs to us as a result of spending time on the internet. So let me give you an example from advertising. So one of the chief values of online advertising versus offline advertising is the fact that you can target it to an individual, right? You can, I can figure out sort of what Jennifer wants and try to target ads to her, to you on that basis. And the other thing too is metrics, right? So metrics are really big. You can figure out the efficacy of your campaign. So we've been doing that on the internet. That's a big value add. And then all of a sudden outdoor advertisers started to think, well, gosh, okay, maybe we can do that on billboards. And so billboards have started to crop up that have cameras in them that can figure out who's looking at them, or some of them, it's true. No, I mean, there's an article in the
New York
Times.
I know, it gets so creepy. Yeah. It freaks me out a little bit, but yeah.
It's life, I suppose. Another example, just to go down the creepy road for one moment, I've seen an instance where there'll be a billboard that will figure out what channels on the radio the drivers are listening to, and will change the content of the billboard on the basis of what people are listening to. So if a lot of people are listening to NPR, maybe it will display a particular advertisement, I don't know, for books or something, you know, whatever it might be. But if people are listening to something else, it will change it to, it'll change it. So these are things that we figured out were possible, I guess, and valuable online, and then we've transported it into the ordinary space. So if you look at it from the perspective of the technical feasibility of all kinds of tracking, I think that the argument that privacy is dead becomes a much bleaker picture. But if you talk about how people feel about their privacy, I think people continue to really value their privacy, and I think I really lament, as a person in this space, I really lament the disconnect between people's values and the state of the technology and the state of the law that protects people.
Yeah. I hear more fear about it than I hear, oh, yeah, let's give it up, you know, in terms of when the discussion actually turns that direction. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was actually less concerned until my PayPal account got hacked. somehow.
Oh, wow.
And I have these like crazy passwords. So really, really weird. And actually before I changed my name when I got married, I guess more people have the name Jennifer Lindsay. So I've noticed this huge increase in, you know, attempts to do things under my name, and I get signed up for lists and stuff that I didn't ask for, you know,
yeah.
Just stuff like that where it's literally changing my opinion of how things kind of work. So what I'm wondering is, in terms of a process point of view at the center, you know, you're a human being out in the world and you're, you know, experimentally, you know, experiencing different trends in technology. How does the process work from, you know, ideation to actually doing the research, and who and how is doing the research? I know that when we met, when you were on a panel for Social Media Club, you had a folder with you of different, pieces of nuggets of information to have things really accurate. And I really thought that was a great thing. But I wondered, you know, how did that packet come together, and kind of who are the people that go into the process of doing the research?
You know, one of the chief advantages, if not the chief advantage of working at a place like Stanford, is the fact that so many people are doing so many interesting things and they want to talk about it, right? So I really got into the thinking about a lot of their own personal research that I do is around how changes to user interfaces affect behavior and attitude and the like. And the reason I got into that was by reading the fabulous work that comes out of Stanford University's communications department. This is Cliff Nass's lab. And in talking to some of the PhD candidates, answering your question, so for instance, them, and the experiments that they were setting up, they were so fascinating in terms of their power, and, it's really sobering in terms of the power that these things had. And let me give you a couple quick examples off the top of my head. One of them is work that was done that was suggesting that if you accompany a weight loss regimen with an avatar of an individual and you show them what their avatar looks like as their body changes, that will be much more effective than merely having somebody do the same regimen on their own. And that's an insight that, of course, has been deployed by video games. But that was originally done in a virtual reality test setting where, I think it was Jesse Fox and folks in Jeremy Valentin's lab actually put that together. That's on the useful side. On the scary side, that same lab showed that because you tend to trust people that look like you, and not just like people demographically that are like you, but literally people that look just like you, you tend to trust them more. They were able to show that people responded subtly better to politicians that look like them, and they were even able to take a politician and have them deliver a message and then subtly morph a picture of the recipient of the information, the watcher, the listener, and the politician in ways that were really not very detectable, but there. And people trusted them more because they had digitally altered this image in order to look more like the person listening. And so these techniques are so powerful that they can't help but generate interest. And so a lot of the research that's being done is being done by folks like this who are just sort of testing limits in technology. A really useful, fertile area for the kind of insights that I try to work with are the people at Carnegie Mellon, Lori Krainer, Alessandro Acquisti, those folks. They're doing really interesting work where they're showing on the ground how individuals react to changes in technology with respect to security and privacy. And so I should say, I am not trained as a communications person or an economist, so I'm more of a person who looks at these insights, tries to build a intellectual framework for them, and tries to argue for explicit use and legal recognition of these ideas. In terms of internal process, basically we read a lot of stuff that's going on, we talk to a lot of people, and then if the center's going to run with something, we have an internal conversation about what our priorities are, and people all weigh in, and Barbara especially, because she's the faculty director, and that's how we come to these things. And sometimes it's, driven anecdotally. I mean, I'm sure that if my PayPal account had been hacked, I might very well have tried to pursue a something about identity theft, right? I mean, because these personal decisions also enter into it. I'm not sure if I answer your question perfectly, but that's sort of a little bit about who's doing the research and how we come to make the decisions that we make.
No, it definitely is insightful. And so one of the things that I wanted to follow up on is how you became an academic fellow in the first place, both from the perspective of folks out there that might want to pursue a path like you have, where, you know, it seems as though you're you know, and in meeting you as I have, you know, you're trying to use the knowledge that you have for the greater good. So that can be applied to many different disciplines. But how does one become, you know, or decide, you know, in your case, to become an academic fellow or, you know, become an academic fellow by happenstance?
Well, first of all, thank you for the I appreciate the charitable comment there. I was a law firm attorney, right? I mean, my bio is very quickly I graduated from Dartmouth College and with a degree in philosophy in the late 90s, and ended up working for a while, and then went to law school. And then from there, after working for a judge for a year, I ended up at a law firm doing regulatory work in privacy and telecommunications. And so I spent a couple of years doing that in D.C., and I thought it was very interesting, but I also was working on behalf of clients, which is wonderful because it's actually quite nice to get a prepackaged problem that you can really put your mind to. But increasingly, I kind of wanted to explore my own, whatever issues I wanted to. I wanted to, you know, be able to speak my own opinion, whatever it might be, and to sort of figure that out. And so having gotten really into the privacy world by doing work for a couple of big companies and doing their privacy work, I decided to sign on as a fellow at Stanford Law School when I saw an opening for the Consumer Privacy Project. And I've stayed on for about a year and a half now, and it continues to get more interesting and exciting and not less. And, when I first got there, it was a difficult, so this is just something for listeners who are thinking about making this transition. I personally found the transition from here's the problem that you need to solve because it will add value or mitigate risk for my company, to here's some books, figure out what you want to do. You know what I mean? I found that to be quite an interesting and difficult transition because to be fully self-directed is hard. And I had a serious ramping up period of time where I was trying to learn a lot and talk to a lot of people. And it took me a little while to figure out my voice and what I wanted to pursue. But having done so, I really love it. The goal is just, I want to explore interesting ideas and, try to sell them to the right people in the hopes of improving the situation, although, you know, that depends on your perspective, right? I mean, some people would come at it and say that I'm probably, you know, that some of the things we do are doing more damage than good. Who knows? It depends on your perspective.
And speaking of perspective, one area that when I work with individual clients, champion and add to strategy documents as sort of the asterisk side note is you need to have an internet policy. And I know that you've done work around this. So I know that there's very divided opinion. What my experience has been is that it's sort of, you know, yay, we know what we can do, so now we're kind of empowered. Or it can be, you know, exactly the opposite. Oh, great, now the draconian laws have come in. And, of course, it depends on the policy. But, you know, having done work in that area, I would love to get your take on sort of, you know, first of all, you know, where you're at with you know, policy, work on internet policies and kind of findings that you can share.
Sure. I mean, so what's so interesting about the policy space is there has to be a way that delineates, that describes the relationship and of the user to the website, right? And so having good policies, whether they're about privacy or how you'll handle law enforcement requests or how you'll handle hate speech, for instance, these are really important ground rules to set. At the same time, there's a lot of research that suggests that people just don't read this stuff, right? I mean, the percentage of people that actually read through policies, certain kinds of policies, others they do look at closely, is relatively small. Sometimes they're not written in a way that's totally accessible. Sometimes they're a little hard to understand. Maybe they're legalese. And there's even some evidence that suggests that that they can do, in some instances, more harm than good, and it for a lot of individuals. So, for instance, there's evidence that people see the link to a privacy policy, and they assume that because there is a link to a privacy policy, that means that the website has to be responsible in certain key ways, like it can't share the information with third parties or some other good practices. When in fact, that's not true, because the policy could say we share information with third parties, for instance. And so sometimes people develop these sort of heuristics. At the same time, having a good policy and some good ground rules allow sophisticated people to go in, like advocates and the regulators and other companies, to go in there and really figure out what the ground rules are. And setting those in advance is, of course, extremely, extremely important. So some of my work focuses on, you know, how can we improve this, and how can we make it so that we get the benefits of policies, which are, you know, setting ground rules, managing expectations, and things like that, but we try to get away from some of the longstanding issues with written policies, which is that people don't read them and they're hard to understand and that kind of thing. And so some examples of that. I'm working on a project where we're thinking about attaching icons that express your privacy preferences about your email. And so, you know how, like, sometimes at the end of an email you see all this, like, stuff, you know, saying, you know, if it's confidential, if you're not the intended recipient, destroy it, or various other things. Or maybe you'll see nothing at all, and you'll just accidentally forward something you weren't supposed to, or you'll reply all, or that kind of thing. Our idea...
Yeah, there's other people that'll have, like, little bracketed boxes, whether it's bloggable or ask first, or, you know, but it's very informal.
Exactly. So and that's very interesting. So we're trying to standardize just that, right? So what we're trying to do, and this is myself and a European academic and some 20%ers at Google, are thinking about coming up with a common vocabulary, kind of these, you know, privicons, these privacy icons that you can attach to your email in an ASCII format so that they don't require a picture to be an attachment. That would standardize this, kind of with the way that Creative Commons does for copyright, but they would standardize your communications. And so I might send you an email, and on that email you'd see at the top or at the bottom an icon, and the icon, we'd all know, says, you know, read but don't forward, or please don't print, or internal use only. Trying to develop this sort of vocabulary that everybody can refer to so that we have fewer instances of this. And it's a way to sort of do it quickly. Other people are working on doing this for entire policies, right? So a variety of efforts, including Mozilla. Mozilla is working on very interesting icons for privacy policies, and they're working on something that would, you know, they'd still have their written privacy policy, so everybody knew, you know, what the words were. But in addition, maybe they'd have some visualization that would sort of show you what happens to your information. And, you know, Mozilla doesn't actually collect much information, and so the risks are not high. But the hope would be that other people would adopt this as well, and they would use this vocabulary to describe how you might expect the company to use your information. And then other folks are working on similar things, like there's this great idea about a kind of like a nutrition label for privacy. So just like you have a FDA mandated nutrition label on your food, this would be a privacy nutrition label that would tell you sort of, you know, all the basic things that you might want to know, and then you'd be able to see it at a glance and compare it easily. So there's all these efforts to sort of improve notice and improve policies.
So one question I have, just to go a little deeper on the policy issue, is something that just personally I'm pretty passionate about, which is nonprofits and social change areas where, for example, child privacy comes into play, and there is a need to right now, you know, you know, can't wait kind of scenario, enforce policy so that basically, you know, there's no HIPAA violation. The healthcare industry has been dealing with this for a while, but this is something that comes up within that sector of the world. And I'm curious if you have any sort of insights as to what seems to work now that could be helpful to people that are working in this area where it's, you know, security around other people and information they might have about those people is so important and critical.
You know, I will try to answer your question. I just want to observe that I think that you've really hit upon a real key problem of our age, and that is that there are all these wonderful reforms that are taking place that are much needed and really important. Things like in the healthcare industry, having information, be electronic and shareable so that people don't duplicate services and they can move their health records around. Another example is developing a smart grid so that we can move towards better energy efficiency. And there are other examples. Grassroots movements is a really good example where people link together in order to form an interest group that is very diffuse instead of being very specific to a corporation or issue. And all these things you'll notice are really information intensive, right? So to improve healthcare in the United States, I think, and I agree with the people that say that that it would be very helpful to have this information be electronic and be able to be shared and analyzed and even stored by individuals. And so I think that and in the smart grid context, in order to be more efficient with our energy use, we need to know what that is and what peak times are. But those have in turn privacy issues. So there's this real sense in which privacy is running against reform. So what works? I mean, you know, the kinds of things that work across the board and always have and I think always will are, number one, you know, only collect the information that you really need to do what you're up to. The sort of concept of data minimization is important. The counter argument there is, sometimes you don't know what interesting thing you might be able to do with data. Sometimes you just want a lot of data and you might want to use it for some purpose. And the example I hear often is Google Flu Trends, which helps identify when the flu is going to happen based on people's search terms. And what I'd say in response to that is that's all well and good, but make sure you're storing the information in a way that is responsible and disaggregates it from the individual so that if you think you're going to be using information down the line, make sure it isn't information that can come back to harm someone. Another one has to do with retention, right? So as I said earlier in the program, if you have this information, somebody can get it with enough process or enough hacking or enough whatever it is. And so retaining information, if you collect the information and retain it, there's a possibility that people can get it. And the third thing is basically try to be as upfront and transparent and make people understand exactly what their information is being collected and what's happening with it. And these basic values have been around for quite a long time in various forms, in various guidelines, and sometimes referred to as fair information practice principles. And I think they can continue to help us in this age of information abundance. I agree to the extent they're suggesting this. I really agree that there's a tension and a problem with all the benefits we have from this information, and then making sure we can safeguard it.
Without going too far down the road, but since you are a lawyer and mm-hmm. I have the benefit of asking someone with authority, to at least, know the law, an interesting scenario came up where I was helping, a nonprofit working on its on some policy for their organization. And the question came up whether individual caseworkers, so social workers, for lack of a better term, could use social media tools to gather information about their clients. So one of the things we know working with at-risk youth is that at-risk youth tend to over-reveal. And that's, it's just a trend and it's you know, it's a separate issue of stopping it. But given that we know that, is it legal, right, moral, all the questions that go into it, but let's ask for you the legal portion. Is it legal for someone to go into, say, a kid's Facebook profile and gather information there for potential use in their work as a social worker?
Sure. So this is a very common response among lawyers you'll hear, I'm sure, which is that it depends. And in the United States, in privacy law in the United States, unlike in Europe and in some other places, we have this really siloed set of privacy laws. So we have specific statutes that govern specific conduct, and they exist at the federal and the state level. And so for one of them, example, is the COPPA, Child Online Protection Act, which requires certain things of commercial websites that gather personally identifiable information about children under the age of 13, if the website is targeted at children under the age of 13, and or they have actual knowledge that children under the age of 13 are using the site, then it triggers all these additional requirements, right? Another example you referred to earlier is HIPAA, which governs health, certain kinds of health information, and it adds, you know, extra security and like. So as to your question about social workers using internet, so it's a really interesting question. So if someone puts something out there on the internet entirely in an unprotected way, there isn't a lot of law that's going to stop anyone from using it. So if the at-risk youth have put their information on a website, and it's publicly available to anybody, you don't have to do anything, then they're going to be able to do it, and it's going to be perfectly legal. Whether it's ethical is another question. But what if, for instance, a social worker, you know, pretends to be somebody else and friends you on Facebook in order to get more information than they could ordinarily get, right? So then you have an issue where,
you've crossed the line.
Yeah, maybe that crosses the line, right? So then maybe there are certain laws that that start to get in there, you know, having to do with, you know, fraud, misrepresentation, or perhaps it's just as simple as in that case the individual has violated the terms of service of the company of the website by pretending to be somebody else. And so, you know, when you start to do things that are misleading in an effort to get more information than you're entitled to, then I think you actually might run into legal problems. But if it's just out there on the internet, you know, there's just not much you can do. I mean, the situation is quite different for copyright. So if something's on the internet and you grab it and use it for your own purposes, there's an overarching copyright regime. It covers all copyright, you know, across the United States, and it gives very specific rights. And so you can get in trouble if you do that. But privacy is not like that. So privacy, there is no one overarching law or set of laws that affects all conduct at all times. And you know, if there's any touchstone, it's this reasonable expectation of privacy. Do you have an expectation that what you have is going to be private? And is it reasonable? And of course, if you put something out on the internet, then you maybe don't have that. So it goes back to the framework I mentioned a little earlier in the program about these four modes of regulation, you know, law and et cetera. You know, maybe the idea here is to make the social norms differently so that people think twice about putting their information out there. And I'll tell you, a lot of people are waking up to the reality that all kinds of players are using your information against you potentially, whether it's insurance claims, whether it's cutting off disability benefits because somebody turns out that they were partying and put their stuff up on Facebook, whether it's not getting a job because someone Googled you and they found that you, you know, are doing a bong hit in the fraternity. You know what I mean? I mean, all these things are happening out there. I can't tell you, I don't think there's too many gatekeepers in society these days, admissions directors, potential employers, even people thinking about going on a first date with someone they don't know well, that doesn't use these sort of search tools. And so people are starting to wake up to the potential misuse of this information. And so it might be just a matter of education rather than a matter of law.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, that's one of those areas where, you know, again, it's got to be, you know, folks that are open and have enough experience to, you know, for example, everyone doesn't have a Facebook profile. So, you know, doing it, it's everybody's at such a different stage, it seems, right now, that it's almost a challenge to train, you know, or even to create a policy, because folks might be signing on to something that, you know, is, you know, they won't get a refresher on what the rules are for a year. So let's say halfway in, they've found Facebook, and oh my God, they're connecting with all these people. And suddenly they're connecting with, let's say, X clients, and using the social worker example. And, you know, I think there's a pretty good case to be made that there's a line that's crossed in that situation. But, you know, the checks and balances, hopefully, or guidance is in the policy. And you're only as receptive as you can understand, I guess, is the, you know, the concern.
Yeah, I mean, and so I should stress. I mean, I'm trained as a lawyer. I'm not. I don't mean to be dispensing legal advice to anyone here in this case, but I will say, generally speaking, that it's about people's expectations of privacy, and it is to some extent a moving target. So Zuckerberg's comments about changing social norms around privacy are true to this extent that. Your expectations change over time. And whereas once maybe you thought that, you know, whatever you were doing was private, as soon as you figure out that it's not, and that it's easy enough to see what you're doing, then a court might shift its analysis. So in other words, it is a contextual question whether your expectation of privacy was reasonable in a given instance. But I do think that it's still the case, even so, it's still the case that if you have a gated community like Facebook and you have your settings in a certain way, it's still reasonable to assume that people can't get at it unless you authorize them, which is why I was, among other people, none too happy about Facebook's decision to unilaterally change a lot of its settings with respect to whether your pictures were viewed, because all of a sudden people who had set their pictures one way as a default and were used to that, all of a sudden their default was switched over to something else. And that's why that's unfortunate, because suddenly you have this expectation about who's going to see your stuff, and suddenly a company has decided to change it on you. That said, I will say this for Facebook. I don't mean to pick on Facebook. I'm really happy that Facebook allows the kind of granular control over information that it does. Because if you think about it, my colleague Lauren Gelman, I mentioned earlier, wrote this great paper about what the value of social networking tools like Twitter, that I know you and I both use a lot, and mm-hmm. Facebook and some others, what the value of those things are is that people have these communities that they want to speak to, but the problem with the Internet has always been that it's this binary. Either you put something out there and it's out there, or you keep it to yourself and nobody sees it. And ideally, if you are, say, a person who is suffering from cancer and you want to reach out to other cancer people, but you don't want anybody to be a part of that community that is not a cancer sufferer or not sympathetic in some way, then maybe you wouldn't put it out there because you're worried about someone joining the community that's not supposed to be a part of it. But at the same time, you want to have this community of people, but you don't know exactly what the boundaries of that community are. In other words, you know, you want to find all the people that are into the thing that you're into, but you're not exactly sure who that is. So you need to simultaneously put it out there that you're interested in this and you're interested in forming a community and make that connection. But at the same time, you have to find a way to limit the onlookers and the people that aren't interested and the people that disagree. And so what good social media tools do, I think, is permit these communities on the terms that the members of the communities want. That's what they're building. That's what Facebook is building, and that's why it adds value, in essence, because it resolves this all-or-nothing binary problem with internet content, and it allows you to form communities that you have control over. And Twitter does it in a different way than Facebook. Facebook is a kind of command and control handshake. You know, I agree, you agree, we're friends, now we can see this stuff. And it further allows us to limit it within that. Whereas Twitter is something where, unless you protect your tweets, basically people can follow you and you can follow them. But still, it's a way to allow you to delineate your community of followers and people you follow and lists. And that's why it adds value. So, you know, I'm not sure how we exactly got onto this, but I think that's a central insight of that's a central insight about the internet, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I was wondering, you know, since we kind of got off on that tangent, it got me thinking about a demo that I saw Jack Dorsey give of, I think the product's being called the Square or the Box. I can't remember. It's the credit swiping technology that allows you to use any audio jack in your device to be able to take credit card payments by swipe.
Wow.
And I don't know if you've seen it, but it's something that Jack Dorsey is a part of, and it's meant to be a part of Facebook. So Facebook eventually can take payments and be transactional, and it has interesting security pieces. I was just curious if you'd heard about it or seen a demo, and your thoughts on it, because it raises tons of privacy issues.
It does, but you know, I don't. I know that you, I know that you're extremely well versed in this stuff, and that's part of the reason I like talking to you, because you you see a lot of things before other people do, and this is one of them. I wasn't aware of this particular product, and I think it does raise concerns, and you know, one of them, of course, being can you mimic the sound or whatever the flow of information is? Does it create other ways to intercept it? But I mean, I'm certainly not against technology. I think if there's a neat new way to make payments, as long as it's done responsibly and securely, I'm definitely all for it. I think sometimes people don't sort of fully recognize the extent of the change. I will say that. So let me give you an example with a voice search function. So there's a sense in which voice search is potentially privacy invasive. You know, there's a privacy danger with voice search, just as there is with any other search, which is, you know, you're asking for something, and that's tied to an IP address, and so people can figure out what you've been searching for. But what voice also adds is the quality of your voice. So voices are self-identifying, right? I mean, that is, we all have essentially very close, you know, very unique voices in many ways, and you can identify your friends and people that you know by their voice. So it's self-identifying in a way that a traditional search query isn't. And also you can get information about a person because of their voice, like, you know, are they intoxicated? Are they angry? Are they foreign?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And so it adds this, having the additional information of your voice is a new way to search, but it doesn't implicate the same privacy values. And then going even further than that, I'd say that just the mere fact that you're saying something out loud when you search rather than typing it into a box and getting results also has a privacy ramification, which is maybe you feel self-conscious saying something out loud. And one of the more interesting ways I wrote a paper on this recently, but one of the interesting things, I think, phenomenon that are going on here is the fact that some of the information interfaces that we see are kind of acting more social, and they're engaging socially. So people are asking questions and sometimes even out loud. And so there's an interesting app called Siri, which uses defense level DARPA artificial intelligence. And Siri is a really cool iPhone app that is kind of like a personal assistant in your pocket. And you just basically ask it questions, and you say, you know, I'd like to go to the movies with Paul. And it knows certain things about you, and it says, well, you know, what movie? And you say, I want to see whatever it is, Nine. And it finds Nine where it's playing near you, and then it automatically, you know, might email Paul and put it onto your calendar. And so there's this interaction that is totally social. And so some of my work focuses on Well, what ramifications does that have for the individual? I mean, if all of a sudden, instead of searching for something just by typing into a text box and getting search results, where it doesn't really feel like you're interacting with anybody, you're just kind of doing it, what if it's more like the old MissDewey.com that Microsoft had, or the current Ouija and some of the other products, where it feels like you're actually asking a question of what feels like a person to you? Does that limit what you search for? Are you going to be less likely to search for controversial things because you feel self-conscious because you're saying it out loud or you're interfacing with something? So I like to think about the ramifications of new technologies that weren't necessarily anticipated as being so different from what there was before. And so that's I say this in response to this this credit card using through your microphone, Jack, because perhaps there are dimensions to it that haven't been fully thought through yet. I mean, I don't know that. Maybe they have thought it through, but technology always just has this opportunity to surprise us.
I totally encourage you to check it out because I think that you would dig on it. Just as a concept,
maybe literally.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty surprising the thought that went into, you know, what Jack explained, and the demo actually didn't work the first time. So, if you've ever seen Jack Dorsey do a demo or present, you know, he can be a little bit. I mean, he's obviously very successful, but he can, you know, be a little bit straightforward, you know, very, and he actually got a little bit animated, so it was actually kind of a really cool demo in that, you know, it took a couple of times to make it work perfectly, so, you know, you got a little bit more of him explaining kind of how it worked, and that's available all on the web video that was streamed live on Ustream, so anyone can check it out that's listening and wants to see what the heck I'm talking about. It was the first piece there. But, you know, with all that said, we only have 4 minutes until the show is over.
Wow, that was fast, yeah.
I know, it was so great, and we definitely have to have you on again to tell us more about some other projects that you're working on, but I wanted to quickly just a 1 minute, what are your predictions for 2010 in terms of, you know, anything related to the kind of work that you're doing?
Okay, my predictions for 2010 are that we're going to be starting to move into from internet to robotics. I think that moving from a space where people are just, you know, manipulating information to a thing where people are manipulating the world, I think that I agree with Bill Gates that we're at the stage today with personal robotics that we were with personal computing in the 70s. And so I think that 2010 is going to show lots of people doing really interesting things with the internet, with social media, that actually have real-world physical repercussions, like, you know, changing the setting on their house, or, you know, one of the examples is like the Rovio, basically it's a webcam that moves around. I think that the internet entering the real world is going to be the prediction, and I think there's going to be lots of interesting ways to monetize that and lots of opportunities for innovation.
Very cool. Internet and robotics. And if anyone wants to check out what Ryan has to say, we have links to some of the things that we've talked about, some of the people we've talked about today. Ryan, if you want to send me any more links, they're all available on my website at jenniferlindsay.com. Obviously, it's the top post right now, so you can take a look or just search Ryan's name, and it's there. And Ryan, I thank you so much for being on the program.
No problem. I really enjoyed it. Thanks very much.
Yeah. You're on a cell phone. Couldn't even tell. Thank you so much. Ryan Kalo, who's an academic fellow for the Stanford University Internet, a Center for Internet and Society. And I thank him for joining the program again. Be sure to tune in on Friday. We have a double feature this week. Our featured guest is Shel Israel, author of Twitterville et al. That's Friday at 12 noon Pacific. As you know, we have a number of other exciting guests lined up for you this year, including Seth Godin, and very excited to talk about what he's up to. You can always keep up with the latest on this show, archives, and free information at jenniferlindsay.com. Have a great evening, everyone.